Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUSCast, Indian Territory and Major Crimes Jurisdiction Edition. I'm your host, Bridget Flaherty. On November 27, 2018, the Supreme Court heard argument in Carpenter v. Murphy, a case considering the 1866 territorial boundaries of the Creek Nations and Indian Country jurisdiction. In 1999, Patrick Murphy, a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation, confessed the killing of George Jacobs. The state of Oklahoma charged him with murder, and he was convicted in state court, receiving the death penalty. In 2004, Murphy sought post-conviction relief in federal district court, arguing that the Oklahoma state courts had lacked jurisdiction because the Federal Major Crimes Act requires that a member of an Indian nation alleged to have committed murder in Indian Territory be tried in federal court. The Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals rejected this argument, concluding Murphy had not shown that the site of the murder fell within Indian Territory. Murphy thereafter sought habeas relief in federal district court, again raising his jurisdictional challenge, among other claims. The district court rejected his argument, but granted a certificate of appealability on the issue. On appeal, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit ruled in Murphy's favor. Noting the parties' agreement that the murder occurred within the Creek Reservation if Congress had not disestablished it or diminished its borders, the court, invoking the Supreme Court's 1984 decision, Solomon v. Bartlett, concluded that Congress had not done so. As a result, the Oklahoma courts lacked jurisdiction to charge and try Murphy for murder. Chief Judge Timkovich, concurring in the denial of Oklahoma's motion for a rehearing en banc, however, suggested that the case would benefit from Supreme Court review. He noted, among other things, that, quote, the boundaries of the Creek Reservation outlined by the panel opinion encompass a substantial non-Indian population, including much of the city of Tulsa. And Oklahoma claims the decision will have dramatic consequences for taxation, regulation, and law enforcement, end quote. The Supreme Court subsequently granted certiorari to consider whether the 1866 territorial boundaries of the Creek Nation within the former Indian Territory of eastern Oklahoma constitute an Indian reservation today under Title 18 of the United States Code, subsection 1151A. And now, to discuss the case, we have Troy Ide, shareholder at Greenberg Traurig.
Carpenter v. Murphy is a fascinating case that's pending now in the U.S. Supreme Court, and it arose from an appeal that came up and was affirmed in favor of the petitioner, Patrick Duane Murphy, by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit. And the case is, just very briefly, it involves a tribe, but it didn't have the tribe as part of the instigation of the case. The situation was an inmate, a guy named Murphy, who was convicted under the laws of the state of Oklahoma in a gruesome homicide. He had killed another member of his tribe. The tribe is the Muscogee or Creek Tribe, a federally recognized tribe in the state of Oklahoma. The crime arose in an area of Oklahoma that was guaranteed in perpetuity to the Creek Nation by treaty. But the question then became, as Mr. Murphy challenged his confinement and said, well, this conviction of me under the laws of Oklahoma is invalid, the question became a much larger issue about the status of that reservation. And in legal parlance, the idea was whether the reservation had been what we call disestablished. That is to say, what happened at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, when Oklahoma had been Indian Territory and then became a state. What happened to the lands that had been guaranteed in perpetuity by treaty to the Muscogee or Creek Nation and by implication to other nations, Native nations, in what was becoming the state of Oklahoma? So this very interesting case that involved an inmate challenging his conviction led to a very large discussion about federal Indian law And it's not a case that the tribe brought or that any Native American tribe brought. It's not a case that a tribe necessarily wanted, and not a case, certainly, I would say, that the state of Oklahoma wanted or perhaps even expected. The status of the reservation in that part of Oklahoma has been, you know, largely a question of more academic interest over the last 100 or so years than of practical interest. And at the risk of great oversimplification, you had the drive towards statehood in Oklahoma. You had a push to try to restrict the authority of tribes, including the Muskogee or Creek Nation, one of the so-called five civilized tribes, as the term was used. But Congress did not exactly make clear how it was going to do this in the state of Oklahoma. And it was an unusual situation because Oklahoma had been the Indian territory, and there are a lot of different tribes that have been removed from other parts of the United States that had been relocated to what is now Oklahoma. So around the time of statehood, the issue became, well, as the state comes into the Union, what is the status of these tribes going to be? Number one, their governments, and they're recognized under federal law. And according to federal Indian law, they have the rights to that recognition by the Congress, which can change the recognition or the respect of the tribe status if Congress chooses to do so. And then number two, the reservation lands. The lands have been set aside in perpetuity. What would happen with those lands? Just because a tribe is federally recognized does not mean that it has a reservation. In our system in the United States, for example, we've got currently 673 federally recognized tribes, but only 320 of them have actual land bases. There are a lot of landless tribes that are still federally recognized as governments in the U.S. system. So the issue of the reservation status was one that began to take shape. A reservation is a reservation of rights. You think about a reservation as an area set aside with the federal government holding the legal title to it for the benefit of, in this case, a particular tribe. Congress has had the ability and has been recognized since at least the late 19th century by the U.S. Supreme Court as having the ability to reduce or enlarge or terminate an entire reservation. Congress also can terminate the recognition of a tribe, a tribal government, and can restore that recognition even after it's terminated it. That's happened many different times in U.S. history. So the interplay between the status of the Muskogee or Creek Nation, which has been federally recognized going back to the very early part of the 19th century, before it was removed to Oklahoma, the recognition of the reservation, which was created by treaty, but then as Oklahoma became a state, it was unclear. And for a long time, obviously more than 100 years, the state has exercised a lot of jurisdiction, nearly complete jurisdiction over these lands. So the question of the case rose, you know, what happens now with this large part of Oklahoma that includes the city of Tulsa? And what is the status of it going to be as a result of one individual challenging his conviction under Oklahoma law and saying that actually, if he was charged at all, he should have been charged and tried in the federal system and subject to the jurisdiction of the federal criminal courts. Recall that in federal Indian law, there is concurrent jurisdiction between the federal government and tribal governments within what the Congress has called Indian country, and which is codified at 25 U.S.C. section 1351. And it's a status of land that is unique in the sense that local law enforcement and prosecution and criminal defense and other issues, indigent defense with public defenders and whatnot, is provided by the federal government concurrently with tribal governments. And so that jurisdiction extends only to Native Americans, or what the statutes call Indians. So that's the term that we use legally, Indians. They could be members of a particular tribe or members of other tribes. But this concurrent tribal federal jurisdiction differs from the background principle we see elsewhere in the U.S., the idea of state authority, so state and local government having authority over crimes, and the federal role sometimes being concurrent, sometimes being exclusive, but again, we tend to think of the federal criminal law as more of an add-on. When I was the U.S. attorney in Colorado, for example, roughly 98.7% of the cases in Colorado during my tenure that were criminal cases arose under state law. So we had the rest of the cases which were federal criminal law in the state of Colorado. So it gives you an idea that U.S. attorneys and federal officials are dealing with an important category of cases, but it's a tiny sliver typically of what is actually out there in terms of law and order. The big difference in our society where that's not true would be crimes occurring on federal reservations like military bases or also Indian reservations. And so U.S. attorneys' offices around the country, there are 32 U.S. attorneys' districts that have Indian reservations in them, federal Indian country, and roughly 20% of all the violent crimes that U.S. attorneys handle overall in the United States arise on those reservations. So you had a very interesting set of particulars arise in this case that began as Murphy versus Royal, and then by the time you got to the U.S. Supreme Court, Royal had been the warden of the Oklahoma State Penitentiary. You had a new interim warden named Mike Carpenter, so now the case in the U.S. Supreme Court is renamed Carpenter versus Murphy. The issues in the matter flow from the question presented, which is literally whether the 1866 territorial boundaries of the Creek Nation within the former Indian territory of eastern Oklahoma constitute a quote-unquote Indian reservation today under that statute I just described, 18 U.S.C. Section 1151, which is the Indian country statute. So that's the issue that's presented in front of the court, and it's a very high-stakes issue for both sides. It'd be hard to get into all the nuances of the argument, but very briefly, there is a body of law that the U.S. Supreme Court has articulated in the Solem v. Bartlett line of cases that deals with what we call disestablishment. What does it take for Congress to no longer recognize a federally reserved Indian reservation as a reservation for that land to become something else? It might be privately owned fee land. It might still be tribally controlled land of some sort, but some or all of its attributes may begin to fall into state rather than concurrent tribal and federal jurisdiction. And there's a test for that in the Solem v. Bartlett case having to do with the manner in which Congress approached what that change in land status was going to be. It began to change that status. In Oklahoma, there was an incredible push towards statehood that prompted Congress to enact numerous statutes dealing with the tribes that were there in the former Indian territory. You can imagine there were tribes that had very specific statutes flowing from treaty obligations the U.S. had entered into with them. You had statutes dealing with groups of tribes like the so-called five civilized tribes, which included the Creek Nation. And then you had larger issues about how would the transfer of federal services to the state of Oklahoma and the creation of state government proceed. The state of Oklahoma took essentially the position in its briefs that the reservation had been disestablished immediately at the time that Oklahoma began to drive towards statehood, that the tribes, in particular the Creek Nation, really was divested, according to the state of Oklahoma, of all authority that it had as a government, and that there really wasn't a thought given by Congress that this tribal nation was going to continue to exercise authorities as a government. So that became the crux, really, of the state of Oklahoma's argument that, notwithstanding the line of cases in Solem versus Bartlett, that this was an unusual and very specific Oklahoma situation where Congress recognized that there was going to be a state here. Congress did a lot of enacting, and all of the enactments that Congress did tended to eviscerate the tribe's remaining self-governance or sovereignty, such that it was a de minimis authority that was left. Also, the state of Oklahoma took the position that an Indian reservation could be, in effect, terminated, or in this case, the term would be disestablished, automatically, in effect, if a tribal government ceased to have any practical way of asserting any jurisdiction over it. So the idea would be that even though Congress didn't necessarily go back and enter into enactments specifically dealing with the reservation status, that if Congress so degraded the authority of the tribal government that the tribe could no longer function as a government, it could no longer, for example, under some acts of Congress in Oklahoma at that time, there had been tribal court systems, but Congress actually forbade the tribes from exercising any jurisdiction over anybody, including their own members, by statute. So the idea was that if tribal authority was so degraded, that by operation of law, the reservation status would also cease to exist at that point as well, and Congress wouldn't have to be as explicit about it. The response from the representatives for the petitioner, Mr. Murphy, who again had prevailed unanimously in the Tenth Circuit, and then also the Muscogee Creek Nation, was able to enter the case as an amicus, and they got some time through Riaz Kanji from the counsel to the Creek Nation from Kanji Katzen Law Firm in Ann Arbor, Michigan. and a very well-known expert in federal Indian law. He had some time also to present his argument, and I really encourage you to take a look at the transcript. It's just fascinating. Their argument was, well, actually, the tribe did still continue to have a functioning government, that, for example, Congress had said, we want you to cede all your land, tribe, that is, you know, give it up for some money to the U.S., and then we'll be done with you. But actually, the tribal government had a legislature, and the legislature said, no, we don't want to do that. And so all Congress could do at the end was something called allotment. You'll see a lot of references to allotment. Allotment was a process that began in the 1870s and continued into the early 20th century around the western United States primarily, where Indian homesteading was promoted by Congress. The idea was, as Teddy Roosevelt said, to pulverize the tribal land base. You would afford a certain amount of acreage to each Indian or Indian household, typically 80 or 160 acres per household. And then after a period of years, that land would pass from federal trust status into private property or fee status. That family would begin to pay state taxes. They would no longer have any reservation status. There'd be no tribal control or recognition of those lands. And that land would pass from the federal domain, in effect, into the state domain by operation of the allotment statute itself. And the allotment statutes, there were dozens and dozens of them just in Oklahoma. They were very specific about the period of years for the allotment and how long it would remain in trust status in this interim period and whatnot. But that eventually it would all be subject to state control. And then the surplus land, if you think about busting up a reservation like the Creek Nation, which was a big chunk of eastern Oklahoma, most of that land would, once you had taken care of the homesteaders who were Indian, you just had a tiny remnant, so you would be able to have the federal government sell off the rest of that land for homesteading to non-Indian settlement. That's the movie Oklahoma, and the stylized version is everybody running out in their with their carts or riding in their wagons and staking a claim. Those are former lands of tribes in that musical where the Indians were getting their allotments and the homesteaders were getting the so-called surplus lands and being able to acquire those lands. That was the Sooners, which were supposedly the people who snuck in earlier before the start of the day when you could go and claim your plot of land. So that's the sort of historical background for it. So both the Creek Nation and Murphy's attorneys claimed, well, actually the tribal governments were still functioning, and they rejected Congress's attempt to cede these lands. They insisted on allotment because allotment would enable the tribes to control jurisdiction over the allotments at least during that transition period, and there was a question under some of the statutes as to whether that control would proceed indefinitely. So they used that as an argument to show that this reservation had not been disestablished, that actually there was always a sense that the tribe occupied it. Mr. Kanji, on behalf of the Creek Nation, quite brilliantly in his time that he had in front of the court, described all the things the Creek Nation has done, even when it was on its knees and meeting in churches, you know, as in effect a government in exile during the 1920s and 30s and so on. The Creek Nation was still functioning and was still asserting jurisdiction over its former reservation lands through policing and other things of its own tribal members, and today provides many government services to both Indians and non-Indians within that vast area, including a lot of social services. And so they had both historical and contemporary facts on their side. As you can imagine, the state of Oklahoma responds to that as, well, if we were to shift all this criminal jurisdiction into federal status, you would overwhelm the tribe's concurrent ability to deal with it, and certainly you would have a major impact on the federal government's ability to police that. And the U.S. briefs talked a lot about the impact on the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's offices and so on that would be affected in Oklahoma, and the increased law enforcement and prosecution responsibilities the federal government would have to perform. There was a group of us, former United States attorneys, who did a brief, an amicus brief. We talked about Congress's plenary power over tribes and the fact that these issues would be properly addressed to Congress because they're treaty concerns. And we talked in our brief about how both on specific reservations through specific enactments and then also generally through statutes like the Violence Against Women Act amendments in 2013 and the Tribal Law and Order Act of 2010, that Congress has not hesitated to change the scope of concurrent tribal and federal jurisdiction and then also federal versus state jurisdiction in criminal matters by statute, because Congress has that authority and they can make adjustments so that if there is a resource issue, Congress can and has Arbery suggested, done this on many occasions, and that this is presumably the process that would be followed in Oklahoma. There's some of that that's referred to in the oral arguments, but most of the oral arguments, just to sort of characterize it, focuses on this issue of, has the Supreme Court's test for disestablishment under Solem v. Bartlett been met? How would this situation be remedied? Would it, the courts be doing that, or would you really just have Congress get together, and what are the chances Congress would do that? In terms of how the justices reacted, interestingly, there had been a case not long ago that Justice Thomas had authored the majority, the Parker v. Nebraska case. It was a case involving the state of Nebraska's ability to regulate off-reservation liquor sales that are targeted at Native Americans in a border town that's just across the line from one of the Sioux reservations in South Dakota. So this is a town called White Clay. It's literally right on the border in northern Nebraska. It's notorious in Indian country. People come to White Clay to buy alcohol. The reservations are dry in South Dakota, but there's a lot of bootlegging that goes on. And then, of course, you can imagine the law enforcement issues that arise with people going off reservation on the roads and whatnot. In that case, the question arose as to whether the Sioux tribes, which had had authority to regulate alcohol on the reservations, had any ability to influence what was going on at White Clay. And the answer was that they did. And Justice Thomas had upheld that, looking at whether White Clay had been disestablished. And he had applied the Solem v. Bartlett test. So there's a fairly recent case that had just applied the same longstanding test. I think it's maybe a 50 or 60-year-old test the Supreme Court has applied. So much of the argument really focused on that issue. The state of Oklahoma really took the position, though, of focusing on the difficulty at a practical level of trying to implement the Tenth Circuit decision, should there be an affirmance. And they focused on, you know, the potential adverse costs and also potential litigation over inmates who had already been convicted under state laws who had maybe used this line of cases, litigation to, you know, in habeas corpus to be able to challenge their continued confinement, essentially saying their convictions, like, as Mr. Murphy had said, were invalid and should be undone. So they talked about the number of violent crimes and so on that might be affected by this. So it was a very strong, I would describe it as more of a public policy approach. There was no discussion either in the briefs or in the oral argument by the state of Oklahoma as to whether Congress could be the forum to fix this. It was much more focused on what would happen in the here and now and how negative the impact would be. And then a lot of focus on the fact that the city of Tulsa falls within this former treaty area. The Muscogee Creek's response to that was that, well, the city of Tacoma is largely on tribal lands in Washington State, that they're kind of the same size cities. And, you know, you can enter into different intergovernmental agreements, and also Congress can enact legislation that can address situations like that if they should arise. So that gives you an idea. I would just describe the justices. Justice Alito, not surprisingly, as a former United States attorney, very concerned about the impact on federal law enforcement. And Justice Kavanaugh really almost purely focused on public policy, didn't discuss disestablishment or question it, was simply talking about the idea that since the state had exercised so much jurisdiction over these lands for so many years, shouldn't that make this different than the disestablishment line of cases? Wasn't this too extreme? I should point out that Justice Gorsuch was recused from the case because he had sat on the Tenth Circuit, although he was not on the Murphy versus Royal panel, but he was recused. You had a lot of questioning from Justice Kavanaugh on the case, and the Chief Justice also questioning, I think, on largely public policy grounds, the impact that this would have on the people in Oklahoma on issues like taxation and so on. Should now an area that the state considers to be within its jurisdiction suddenly become, you know, subject to federal jurisdiction in a way that might interfere with taxation? And as I mentioned, that there were responses on the part of the Creek Nation, not the least of which is that there are limitations on what tribes can do with respect to non-Indians in the jurisdiction they can assert. Presumptively, under federal law, tribes do not have civil jurisdiction, either adjudicative or regulatory, over non-Indians. And you saw that in the arguments both for Mr. Murphy's counsel and then also especially in Rias Kanji's arguments on behalf of the Creek Nation, explaining that the line of cases in matters like the Atkinson Trading Post case versus Shirley in the U.S. Supreme Court about 20 years ago made it clear that tribes presumptively lack civil, regulatory, and adjudicative jurisdiction over non-Indians, so that there wouldn't be an effect like this. That in Indian law parlance is called the Montana Doctrine. this presumption against tribal jurisdiction over non-Indians. So they tended to say that the state's arguments were hyperbolic, and if there were issues, that Congress could simply address those, and that the idea that there would be all these non-Indians that would be trying to seek their release under state law was questionable, because you'd have to have them fall within the, you know, what would have been the scope of federal criminal jurisdiction over Indians, concurrent federal tribal, which would be you have to have an Indian victim and Indian perpetrator also in the typical crime. At a minimum, you'd have to have an Indian victim. If you have a non-Indian perpetrator and an Indian victim, you would have exclusive federal jurisdiction under federal law going back to the late 18th century in the United States. For crimes involving Indians, you typically have them federal and tribal concurrent jurisdiction under the so-called Major Crimes Act of 1885 and some other statutes that are applicable, including something called the Indian Country Crimes Act. But the vast majority of crimes that have been committed obviously don't involve Indians, because there aren't that many members of the Creek Nation, and this is an area where more than 90% of the population is non-Indian these days. So you're not going to have this kind of an effect. But it does add a layer of complexity as a result of having to draw these distinctions, which have not really been drawn for the most part in the felony context. Mr. Kanji did point out, however, that the tribes do already, in the area of their former reservation, they do enforce their own criminal laws, which are limited by Congress essentially to misdemeanors. They do and have continuously for the last several decades enforced those laws already in the same territory. Judging from some of the questions that seem to be new information for a lot of the justices, you get the sense when you go through the transcript or when you listen to what was happening in the courtroom that this was really new territory for a lot of them. The most assertive questioners of all were Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan, very strongly adhering to the Solem v. Bartlett line of cases and focused on the fact that at the time of statehood, from a legislative history matter, it was clear that Congress began the process of trying to terminate the tribes, but then reversed course around the time of statehood and very explicitly decided to leave them in place, and it passed a series of enactments recognizing both tribal governments as continuing in full force and effect, and then also, they would say, recognizing the status of the reservations. So looking at what Congress did and really parsing the statutes along with the legislative history, you had very assertive questioning from those two justices. Justice Breyer participated very heavily and seemed to be sort of steering a middle ground, asking questions hard to characterize whether he was more on one side or the other. He just seemed to be drawing out the nuances, especially of the legislative text and history. And Justice Thomas not asking any questions, and Justice Ginsburg just, I believe, asked one, you know, short question. So you didn't have necessarily any big surprises in the questioning. You did have some very intense interaction between the counsel for the state of Oklahoma, Ms. Blatt, and especially Justice Kagan. Ms. Blatt adhered very strongly to the line. She kept using the phrase of how catastrophic this was going to be. And there ended up being a lot of pretty intense conflict. Surprising, as a Supreme Court observer, I've rarely in my career seen so many sparks flying between a justice and an oral advocate in court. So it'll be interesting to see how that comes out, if it has any effect on it. But read the transcript, you'll see the almost constant back and forth, page after page, between Justice Kagan and Ms. Blatt. And at one point, Ms. Blatt telling Justice Kagan she was fundamentally and factually wrong, and Justice Kagan saying fundamentally and factually. So it's pretty interesting, regardless of what one's position is, pretty entertaining read. So what are the stakes and what's going to happen next? Hard for me to predict, as I've already disclosed, you know, I have a dog in the fight, so I have a desire that the Tenth Circuit would be affirmed in this matter. You do have Justice Gorsuch recused, so if you had a 4-4, you'd have the Tenth Circuit opinion stand. I think we'll probably have either a 4-4 decision here, or you will have one vote swing either way. It's going to be a close case based on at least my review of the transcript. The fact that you had U.S. senators from the Oversight Committee, the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, actually seated in the courtroom from both parties made it quite clear that should this be affirmed, that Congress will be getting an earful from the state of Oklahoma, and I think rightly so, from others, including the tribes, about what do we do now? And I have got to think that if there is an affirmance, there will be legislation probably quite quickly to address this situation on different levels. I would note that there are numerous statutes involving individual tribes where, for example, the Congress might say, City of Tulsa and surrounding environments, you are just not going to be in tribal jurisdiction. We will leave you alone. And I can completely see them carving up for jurisdictional purposes by statute saying, well, while the reservation boundaries are here, we, the Congress, is only going to recognize tribal and federal concurrent jurisdiction in a portion of the reservation that is primarily inhabited by members of the Creek Nation, for example. So I think if this is affirmed, you will likely see some very robust efforts in the near term to address some of this by statute. And I think, as a personal matter, rightly so, that would need to happen. In terms of the changed expectations from the status quo, that would seem to be absolutely required from my standpoint. And then finally, how does it affect other cases? The Solem v. Bartlett line of tribal disestablishment cases is very well established and has been, within federal Indian law, one of the most consistent doctrines from its outset. It looks at very practical considerations in terms of what the Congress said it did. The concept of Indian law is that Congress, pursuant to the Indian Commerce Clause in Article 1, Section 8, has the ability to regulate all the connections or relationships with tribes. And that's explicit in the Constitution. The Court has described it as plenary power. Congress has this plenary power. It can expand, it can contract tribal recognition, it can terminate tribes' entire existence. In the 1950s alone, Congress terminated more than 100 federally recognized tribes in the United States. Sometimes they go back. Tribes terminated in the 50s, for example, or the early 60s. Klamath tribe in Oregon, for example, terminated by Congress in 1961. President Ronald Reagan in 1986 restored its recognition in 1986 after Congress had passed an act to do this. So you just have to understand that Indian law can be a very complicated and very land and tribally specific endeavor, and it usually is. It is seldom a partisan endeavor, but it does involve some pretty intense local interests. This case, though, has pretty profound implications for tribes around the country because, from a tribal standpoint, it deals with treaty power. The authority to abrogate treaties is one that is exclusively vested in Congress. And so if Congress were to depart from that Solem v. Bartlett concept and look at, well, you know, if a state's been doing something, even if it's incorrect, because we don't know what Congress decided for sure back in 1906, 1907, but we're going to just leave it alone, if they go that route, that tends to throw a lot of issues dealing with treaties into question. By way of illustration, last term, we had the U.S. versus Washington case, and in full disclosure, I authored a brief on behalf of the National Congress of American Indians in that case, an amicus brief. That's the case that deals with the state of Washington's attempt to continue to manage culverts or tunnels under roads and bridges pursuant to state law versus the tribe's insistence that actually there were tribal treaty obligations between Native tribes in what is now the state of Washington and some other Northwest states that guaranteed a certain percentage of being able to take fish at ordinary and customary places. So places where tribes pre-white contact would be fishing and taking fish on rivers and streams in the state of Washington, protected by perpetual treaty, that the tribes had brought suit in federal court to say, well, the state has built these culverts. Granted, they're according to federal standards in many cases, but the state can't interfere with our federal right to take fish at our ordinary and customary places. If a culvert prevents salmon and other species from being able to spawn properly because they can't get up through the pipe to get to the spawning grounds upstream, then we have a treaty violation, and the U.S. has to enforce that. Well, that was a case not unlike this one. It had a broader treaty implication for any tribe that has a treaty because the argument went, Congress has the right to abrogate, and it's exclusive. States don't have the right to abrogate treaties. Washington, the tribes would say, can't just go, even if it's adhering to federal specifications for building bridges and culverts on highway systems, states can't go and impinge on a treaty that says you get a right to fish at your ordinary and customary place. Well, in that case, U.S. v. Washington last term, the Ninth Circuit had ruled in favor of the tribal position, and then it went to the Supreme Court, and 4-4 decision, you ended up with the Ninth Circuit being affirmed by operation of the 4-4 vote. And so that case ended up standing, as it was, with the tribe prevailing in the Ninth Circuit. And so from a tribal standpoint, this case is very much like the U.S. v. Washington case, in that tribes are looking at this as in terms of their treaty obligations and the federal government's responsibility for that. You can imagine the state of Washington's position in U.S. v. Washington saying it will cost us, the estimates varied in the case on remand now, but the state has estimated close to $2 billion to reconfigure their roads and bridges in this manner that the tribes wanted. The tribes thought it might be around $600 million. We can all agree it's a lot of money, and we'll see what the court does on remand. But the bottom line is that there's a huge impact on the state government by operation of enforcing a tribal treaty right between the federal government and a tribe. As Federalist Society members remember, one of the most salient points of the Constitutional Convention was the failure in the Articles of Confederation to address federal relations with tribes. Recall the Articles were very vague and contradictory on this point, but they allowed states to continue to enter into their own agreements with tribes and effect their own treaties, which tended to lead to, in that era, warfare and other, you know, significant issues. And ultimately, one of the driving forces for the federalization of Indian law was present in the Constitutional Convention, because the consensus ultimately was that the Articles had failed and that this was really a federal responsibility. The federal government should enter into the treaties and the relationships with tribes, and that if every state did its own policy toward federally recognized Indian tribes, you know, there would be chaos and inconsistency and whatnot. So going back to the origins of our country, this could not be a more interesting set of issues to explore and discuss and debate, regardless of one's position in Carpenter versus Murphy or any other case, U.S. v. Washington, or the others I've been talking about today. There could be nothing more relevant for Federalist Society members who are interested in the origins of our country than this kind of set of cases. We will undoubtedly have many other treaty rights cases. There are a lot of them in the works right now in the circuit courts that are coming up in different contexts, often without the tribe's direct involvement. Finally, I just say it was noteworthy that the U.S. Supreme Court recognized the Creek Nation as an amicus and then allowed oral argument from the Creek Nation. This is something that tribes have often not requested. And when they have requested, it's sometimes not been granted. It is noteworthy in this case that Mr. Kanji was able to argue at all in the U.S. Supreme Court. You will now see, I guarantee, many more tribes attempting vigorously to make their own arguments rather than rely on the United States in U.S. Supreme Court litigation. And of course, we typically have at least 2 to 4 important federal Indian law cases every term.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.